I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Higher Education to order. We have several bills on the agenda today, and so we will go ahead and start. We've got Senate File 591, which is Senator Nelson's bill, and she has several people, I guess, who are with her. So please join us here at the table. And
did you get one?
Yes, and I have your money.
Oh, okay.
So Senator Nelson, welcome to the committee. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. Thank you for hearing Senate File 591 today. It's a bill appropriating money for the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Foundation Partnership. I see some new faces at the table, so I'll give you just a little history. The Minnesota Partnership was formed 7 years ago under the leadership of Governor Tim Pawlenty, and it was with the intent of bringing together Minnesota's two premier research institutions to advance the state's position in the emerging biotech industry. I was pleased to author that bill in the House as a House member at a similar time, a time of historic budget deficit, yet we saw that this was a need. And I remember those discussions clearly. There was thoughts that perhaps we had missed the boat. There were other states racing to grab a share of the economic activity offered in the bioscience and biomedical research. And some thought that we were too late in entering this field. But in bringing together these renowned medical and research assets of the Mayo and the university, Minnesota sent a signal to the rest of the nation and the world that we intended to be a major player in this arena. The state's investment in the partnership has been an investment in an industry that will be one of the defining fields of the 21st century, and it's paying off. In just 7 years, the partnership has become a globally recognized model of research, innovation, and collaboration. It has exceeded expectations, leveraging more than $100 million in external funds and advancing major medical research. As Senator Miller and I have heard in our deed Jobs and Economic Committee, the deed report presented showed that health and education will be two of the top sectors for job growth, and a partnership between our world-class health and education research institutions is strategic positioning of our state's key assets. This partnership is about economic opportunity. But more importantly, it's also about improving health and saving lives. Whether it's cancer, heart disease, diabetes, or Alzheimer's, we should be proud that Minnesota researchers are focused on breakthroughs. As our state grapples with skyrocketing health care costs, we need to support this work now more than ever. Madam Chair, with that, I would like to turn over the presentation to Dr. Eric Wieben.
Thank you, Dr. Wieben.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Eric Wieben, and I am the Mayo Project Leader for the Minnesota Partnership and Medical Genomics. Senator Nelson has done a good job of introducing the capsule history of the partnership and our goals and highlighting some of our accomplishments. I guess I would just like to emphasize that the partnership really does have dual goals, and the first is to improve the health and health care for Minnesotans, and the second is one of economic development. And in the 7 years the partnership has been going now, we are beginning to have a real impact in both of those areas, and we'll let Dr. LeBien say a few words about that in a minute. The only other thing I would like to bring to the committee's attention is that the state support, in addition to providing us with additional research space for partnership activities on the Mayo campus, which was a bonding bill, the state support is used to support collaborative research projects, which must have a principal investigator from Mayo working with a principal investigator from the University of Minnesota. And these are competitive projects that are quite heavily reviewed, and we only fund about 25% of the applications we get, which is similar to the funding success percentage you see at institutions like the National Institute of Health. We fund infrastructure projects to help keep our activities and equipment up to date and competitive with other activities around the country and around the world. We funded some joint recruitments, and again, these are paired with one investigator coming to Mayo and one coming to the University of Minnesota to fill some gaps in our talent pool. And lastly, we funded one activity that's been focused on trying to improve the commercialization value of some initial findings coming out of partnership research. And again, I'll let Dr. LeBien tell you a little bit more about some of the outcomes.
Yeah, thank you, Eric.
Dr. LeBien, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tucker LeBien. I'm Associate Vice President for Research in the Academic Health Center and the Project Manager on the University of Minnesota side of the partnership, a position I've been in for a little over a year. Although I've been at the university for a long time and know the successes of the partnerships extremely well. So one of the questions that you have either asked or would like to ask is, what kind of outcomes have we had with the investment that you've made in this partnership? And one of the key parameters that we use to assess the success of the grants that we fund is, of course, whether the investigators go on to obtain subsequent funding from the National Institutes of Health, which, of course, is the premier benchmark of research success in this country and in the world. And of the 45 or so grants that have been funded in the history of the partnership, we have successfully leveraged that into about 57 grants from the NIH, which average about $1.1 million per grant. So we have been able to obtain an additional $60 million of support that's gone into the University of Minnesota and Mayo. We use some parameters that the NIH, or some calculations that the NIH has made in the past, which suggest that for every $1 million of grant support, there are 16 jobs that benefit from that $1 million. So we could do a calculation to determine that there's been an impact on about 960 jobs in the state of Minnesota. The only other thing I'd like to emphasize, given that the senator has graciously agreed to support this bill for an additional $1 million on the current $7 million, which would bring us back to the $8 million that we've had in the past, is the issue is what will that provide? How will that help us? And in essence, what it will allow us to do is fund at least one additional research proposal. And Eric mentioned that we fund around 20 or 25% of the applications submitted. And I can tell you that of the other 75%, if you ask me the question, well, are those examples of poor science or lousy science or bad ideas, I would tell you the answer is no. And in fact, there's a sweet spot we'd like to arrive at, which is about one-third of submitted applications being funded based on a lot of experience we've had and that the NIH has had as well. So we are grateful to have the opportunity to share our perspectives and would be happy to answer any questions, unless, Eric, you have anything else you'd add now?
Madam Chair.
Dr. Weaven.
Just a few last notes on progress issues. Dr. LeBien mentioned that we have had a positive response from NIH to partnership advances based on the research projects. That's also true on the infrastructure side. Those infrastructure grants that I mentioned, I'm aware that one of those was focused in part on purchasing some new instrumentation. And based on the uses of that instrumentation, another two NIH grants of $12 million each were awarded last year. So that also is helping to bring additional funding into the state. And on the healthcare side, partnership investigators have identified some new markers for aggressive prostate cancer, developed some new antifungal drugs to prevent and treat fungal diseases. And stretching a little farther afield, partnership investigators have also developed a new insecticide that works against soybean aphids that is not harmful to humans. And those are all things that are in the process of being further developed for possible commercialization. So I think our impact has been quite significant given the short time we've been in business, and we're quite proud of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. This is The $8 million you're asking for is a $1 million increase, or is it in addition to the $7 million that you're receiving now?
No, It is the current year, the FY11 budget is $7 million, and I believe that the proposal is to add an additional $1 million to that $7 million to bring it to $8 million.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, I don't know who this is for. It says this appropriation is available until expended. Have you spent the $7
million? The $14 million.
Or the $14 million? Have you spent the $14 million from the last biennium? Or is spending $16 million in the next biennium going to be a problem? Or what are you guessing here? Sounds like you're guessing.
Dr. Labian, you look like you
want. We try very hard not to involve guesswork. So let me give you some examples. The $7 million that you appropriated to us last year, we have, as of today, I believe, spent about $4.5 to $5 million and have a final round of infrastructure grants competition that will be completed by the end of this fiscal year that will spend that remaining $2 million. The past years of support that you've provided us have essentially entirely gone into either the research or the infrastructure grants program, and that's about the best I can tell you as far as where we stand.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
So is this money for infrastructure also? Because I don't see that in this. Unless I'm missing something here. Direct and indirect expenses for the collaborative research partnership between University of Minnesota and for research in biotechnology and medical genomics. So is infrastructure also part of this money?
Dr. Labian.
Yes, the award that we receive from the state funds both what we call research grants and infrastructure grants. So they're bundled together under the same funding mechanism. They just fund two different things at the local level when we actually distribute the money.
Madam Chair.
Dr. Wieben.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, my colleague is exactly correct. Actually, we have used the partnership dollars in support of the four activities that I outlined: research grants, infrastructure grants, recruitments, and commercialization activities. And this was part of our original planning, and we followed through on that. I think the other thing I'd like to note is that the bill that we're discussing is actually designed to restore funding to previous levels. The funding, we were in the base for $8 million a few years ago. That got reduced through other budget cutting in years past. And the intent here is to restore us back up to the level that we had.
Madam Chair, does this
Senator Tomasoni.
Does this language, does it give you enough flexibility? Is direct and indirect expenses? That's pretty a wide range of things, but is that what you wanted to say?
Dr. Wieben?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, yes. I think, again, in terms of more detailed expenditures and returns on those expenditures, it has been in all the four areas that I've outlined, and we can give you detail if you wanted that. But, yes, I think that gives us the flexibility we need to do our best job to meet our dual goals of improving health care and bringing some economic benefit back to the state from partnership activities.
Further discussion on that? Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Nelson, where does the money come from, other than just saying the general fund, which doesn't have any money?
This is out of the higher ed appropriations.
Senator Nelson.
As it has been in the past.
Senator Latz.
Out of which fiscal year, then?
Senator Nelson. This...
Madam Chair,
this is fiscal year 2012 and 2013.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I'm just asking, I guess, a question about fiscal balance. If there's an extra $1 million, available in the higher ed budget. I mean, what else is being cut to make room for this, or is there some other change being made to increase funding for a program that's already in the pipeline? And we've been
looking
at cutting budgets around here, not increasing them, so I'm wondering where this money's coming from.
Senator Latz, I mean, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion, and it will be, you know, part of the whole decision-making process.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Miller.
Madam Chair, I move the Senate File 591 that we laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senator Miller has moved that Senate File 591 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Nelson. We really appreciate it. And I just wanted to mention, Senator Lori has taken a seat there back behind the table. If you'd like to join us at the table, my understanding is that Senator Lori will be replacing Senator Anderson, but the paperwork hasn't been done yet, so he's not official yet, but we would welcome you at the table if you'd like to sit.
Voting or anything.
Well, we'll make sure that that doesn't happen.
Senator, over here, Senator Saxon's not here today if you want to come over.
Sit over there. Then I might get confused because they look so much alike. Next on the agenda, we have Senate File 799, Senator Miller. And I understand that there are several people here to that want to testify on this bill, if they'd like to come to the table also. Senator Miller, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Whenever you're ready, Senator.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, Senate File 799 would limit the liability of Minnesota colleges and universities when student record data they are required to share with the Office of Higher Education is misused, breached, or improperly disclosed by the Office of Higher Education or other state agencies or contractors to whom the Office of Higher Education grants access. And I have a couple folks that can explain this legislation in more detail, but I do want to mention that this is the first stop for this legislation, and my hope would be to send it to the Judiciary Committee, where I think more of the details can be worked out. But please, I have a couple of testifiers here.
Mr. McMahon, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Fischbach. Chair Fischbach, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott McMahon. I'm the Director of Government and Community Affairs of the Minnesota Private College Council. We represent the 17 private nonprofit liberal arts colleges across the state. We educate about 45,000 undergrads and about 15,000 graduates per year, graduating significant numbers in critical areas such as STEM disciplines, healthcare, teacher education programs, and so on and so forth. I'm also joined today by Phyllis Karasoff, a leading expert on data liability and student record state and federal regulations. Hopefully between the two of us, we can answer most, if not all, of your questions you may have today. This bill does exactly what Senator Miller laid out. Right now, as a portion of our requirement under state law and participation in the state grant program, we are required to provide certain data on our students to the Office of Higher Education for the purposes of research and analysis and trying to figure out how to make the state's public policies work better. One of the issues that we currently have, and we've had for some time, is the issue that that we're giving up control of the data that we're required to share. The Office of Higher Education gains access to that data, and we don't have direct control over how that data is used, what sort of security parameters are placed around it, how that data is protected. Please know that within our institutions, we take our student data and their privacy very, very seriously. We have considerable controls around our institutions to guarantee to the best of our ability that that data is used in an appropriate fashion and is not disclosed in inappropriate methods. Unfortunately, one of the things that can happen with data is that breaches can happen. We've seen examples within this state in the past few months. We've seen examples across the nation over the past few years about how data has been misused by government agencies. And what this bill would do is simply limit the liability and the ability for individuals to come back to our institutions with claims when the misuse of the data happens once it's gone beyond our control. One of the reasons that this is becoming more important moving forward is the state is moving forward in creating what's called the State Longitudinal Education Data System, which will expand the scope of who has access to this data. Right now, and for the past many years, this data that we share has only been available to the Office of Higher Education. This is an agency that all of our schools work very closely with, who we have a very strong relationship with, even through administration changes as we're seeing right now. We have the ability to work very closely with the Office of Higher Education to make sure that we do have the safeguards in place and the best capacities to protect the data that we're able to work with. However, moving forward with the State Longitudinal Education Data System, the data is going to be available to a broader cohort of state agencies, including the Office of Enterprise Technology and the Department of Education. These are two agencies that our institutions do not have relationships with, we do not have connections with. We can't even tell you within those agencies who the people are that are controlling the data. Our concern is elevated at this point due to the fact that that there are going to be more hands around the data, the risk of some sort of of data breach or misuse, although still extremely insignificant, is elevated just by the nature of things moving forward. And this this bill would simply help mitigate the risk that our institutions have to bear by the nature of participating in the state's financial aid programs. At this point, I'm happy to turn things over to Phyllis Karasoff to talk a bit more about the liability side of things.
Ms. Karasoff.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. Despite the best intentions of the various agencies which will be in possession of confidential student records and data, the fact is that incidents of disclosure of confidential information is now becoming far more common by both private entities and governmental entities. And in recent years, there have been reports that over 285 million records have been compromised through security breaches. Just in 2011, there have been reports of several hundred thousand documents that have been improperly disclosed. There is a Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, which has on their website a list of a chronology of data breaches, and just for 2011 alone, there's a significant number, including one that occurred on January 30th, 2011, by the Minnesota Department of Education, when the transcripts of 20 students of a charter school was accidentally released to the public. There are a number of causes of action which arguably could be made against an institution of higher education for disclosing information. They could include tortious invasion of privacy, negligence, breach of contract, fraudulent misrepresentation, and negligent misrepresentation. And again, these claims would only occur if information is improperly disclosed by the Office of Higher Education or the other governmental entities that will now be receiving this data. A student whose information was disclosed would most likely sue both the state of Minnesota and the private or public institution that he or she attended. And the proposed statute applies to both public and privates. But the reality is that public institutions have limitations as to liability. There's sovereign immunity, and there's also the Minnesota Tort Claims Act, which will greatly limit the liability of the state of Minnesota. Whereas for private institutions, they don't have those limitations, and any amounts could be claimed against the private institutions. They could very likely be viewed as the deep pocket and therefore a more attractive defendant than the state. In addition to the potential civil liability, there's also a possibility of criminal liability arising from the improper disclosure of confidential information. Those who violate the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act can be found guilty of a misdemeanor. There are several other states that also have immunity statutes covering these kinds of disclosures because nationwide, the state longitudinal studies are something that are occurring. In addition, in the state of Minnesota, there are over 150 separate statutory provisions of state law that provide some type of immunity. So there's already in place in state law a number of circumstances under which immunity is provided to various individuals and entities. There's also been a recent lawsuit brought against the University of Hawaii. There's a class action that was brought in November 2010 concerning disclosure of private and personal information of students and alumni. And in that lawsuit, the plaintiffs are seeking an injunction as well as monetary damages and attorney's fees. So the potential liability is great, and the purpose of this immunity statute would be to limit that liability. And I would be happy to answer any questions that any of you may have.
Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing no questions from the committee, Senator Miller, my Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair. I don't have a question for the testifiers, but I'm wondering if the Office of Higher Education has a position on this bill.
Is there someone here from the office who could? Mr. Michikanis.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, Mark Michikanis with the Office of Higher Education. The office is fine with this. Of course, our obligation is to keep the data from being disclosed ever in the first place. We certainly operate currently under protocols from the Office of Enterprise Technology, so we're very sensitive to that. So we understand the position of the bill's author and the testifiers, but we have no objection to the bill.
Thank you. And I understand Mr. Neumeister would like to make a testify in this bill. Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. And for those people that are new to the process that have not been here before, I've been a leading advocate on issues of privacy and government information for decades here at the state legislature and have worked with lawmakers on developing policy in these kinds of areas. Let's be and cut to the chase. This is a bill that could basically give immunity to institutions where they could be involved in sharing information with other government entities and they will not be liable, which I think they should be. The thing is that we're talking about hundreds of thousands, as the previous testifier just indicated. This involves public and private entities. So to start out, the bill, I think, that when you look at the, when you hear what they say, this is for the, I can't say it, whatever the study. What's the nickname for it? SLES or something like that. But it's for this longitudinal study. But the language, when you read it, it doesn't say that. It's very broad. There are many organizations that information, whether it be private colleges and universities or public universities or not, give a fair amount of information to these three entities, Office of Higher Ed, Education Department, and all that. So the bill is different than what is being told, and that can be in drafting errors. And even talking with the proponents of this bill, which is basically the private colleges, by maybe the next stop, it will be narrowed down specifically to what they're trying to do. So that's the first concern I have. The second item is that I've learned some things over the years, is to ask the questions, well, what really is the problem, and what are you trying to fix? Now, the 150 statutes that was referred to in public testimony just a few moments ago, yes, there is immunity. But a lot of times it's very, very narrow. And I don't see this being the case. I see this as a new kind of thing. This is language that at least the concept of, whether it's specific, I don't know, came from Georgia or some other state statute that they referred to. And number three, and the final point, is that we have the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. And I don't know that if you have this broad immunity, what that's the impact on when you, again, the definition, what is the definition on line 1-6? Institution of higher education. That's the University of Minnesota, MinSCU, and maybe others, but at least, you know, they come under the Data Practices Act. So when you share information from one government entity to the other, the data practices applies. And I've never seen immunity protection for a public entity when a public entity is sharing the same data that's protected to another government entity. Because if we went that kind of way, we'd have immunity statutes for any time that government entities want to share information with a government entity. We don't do that. We basically have what we call the traveling classification. So if it's private in one government entity and you share it with another, it's private. So the bill needs to be focused, narrowed down a little bit, and even basically from my concept, I still have questions whether or not we should be doing this based on how I've seen the history of immunity statutes of liability. So, Madam Chair, members of the Higher Education Committee, I know the drill. I've seen it many times, and it's good that you do, but at least this bill is going forward. I think it's important for you to be informed, to follow, because these are important issues, the privacy of citizens and people of the state of Minnesota, particularly young people. You don't want something coming out 10, 15 years later. The bottom line is privates also need due diligence, not just share it and then take no responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee, may I just make one clarification?
Karaskoff? I'm sorry, I keep mispronouncing
myself. That's okay. It's a mouthful.
Okay.
There is a federal law called FERPA, which is the Family Responsibility and Privacy Act, which does govern the kinds of data that an institution of higher education can share with others, including the government. And so the type of data, there's great restrictions on what can be shared, and the type of data that we are talking about is already covered by federal law as far as the extent to which it can be shared. And the exception in FERPA under which this information would be shared is an exception which allows a governmental agency to conduct audits or evaluations of federal or state-supported education programs.
Thank you. And Senator Miller?
Madam Chair and members, Mr. Neumeister brought some of those concerns to my attention just today, and we are going to work with him to address some of those issues. Again, this is the first stop through the process, so we will be addressing some of those issues that he mentioned.
Senator Peterson, did you still have a question?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And I'm not sure who the best person to answer this is, but what's the most sensitive type of information are we talking about? Is it parents' tax returns or Social Security numbers, or what's the worst or most sensitive type of information we're talking about here?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, just to expand on that one a little bit farther, the vast majority of the data that we're talking about are things like name, gender, race, what's your degree of study, do you have a minor, those types of general education data. One of the items that is included is a Social Security number, and that's probably, from a public disclosure standpoint, the most sensitive thing that gets out there. If you release somebody's Social Security number along with their name, and this would likely have their birthday as well, those three data points, you can do a considerable amount of damage to an individual's credit rating if the wrong person gets their hands on those three data points.
Senator Peterson.
So in regard to this issue, the problems that you're seeing or experiencing, that there hasn't been parents' information mistakenly released?
Chair Fischbach, Senator Peterson, to the best of my knowledge, there's no parent data that's being transferred from our institutions to the Office of Higher Education. It's the data that we're looking at right now is solely tied to the individual student. The vast majority of it is linked to their actual education track going forward. A lot of focus is paid towards, you know, what's their course of study, what's their degree level, what's their year in school, that type of basic biographical and demographic information is the primary data that the Office of Higher Education does collect on the student standpoint. but in part of collecting enough data so that we can do matchings from a student from year to year, or as a student transfers from a Minsk institution to one of our institutions, or from our institutions to Minsk or the University of Minnesota, we have enough identifiers, including name, date of birth, social security number, that allow us to effectively track that student as they move from higher ed system to higher education system.
Senator Tomasoni.
Chair, Senator Miller, you said you had discussions with Mr. Neumeister, and I think one of the things he said was, is the bill even necessary? Why is the bill necessary?
Ms. Karas.
Karasoff.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, I think the reason that this bill is necessary is because if the information such as the social security numbers and the names and addresses get into the wrong hands because of a security breach, and there were some claim brought against an institution of higher education, the institution wants to be protected because it's not their actions or omissions that resulted in that security breach. They have no control over that data once it's given over to OHE.
Senator Tomasoni, you have a follow-up?
I'm not sure. It sounded like it's already covered in data practices and everything. And is this just a second layer of insurance? Is that what we got here? Or is...
Mr. McMahon?
Senator Fischbach, Senator Tomasoni, there's greater understanding on the public side. There is not an understanding on the private side. We do not fall under the data practices statute in the state. The only place where we really get pulled in on that is in connection with the state longitudinal education data system going forward. So right now, specifically within the private nonprofit and the private for-profit, the liability is definitely out there and is not addressed anywhere in state statute.
No,
Senator Miller.
Madam Chair, I'll just add to that, and Senator Tomasoni, this was brought forth by a private university in Winona, St. Mary's University, and they just, along with the other private colleges and universities in the state, they would feel more comfortable if this was put in place, because they don't feel that they are necessarily covered by the current legislation or the current statute.
Senator Carlson, to that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I get this right, if St. Mary's in Winona has a breach of information, they have not given it to anyone else, they have a breach within their organization, that is a problem for them that would not be covered by this. Okay. But it is when they have to answer some question to the Office of Higher Education and they transfer that, they're just trying to say, hey, if the Office of Higher Education screws up, we don't want to be held liable for their mess up. Maybe that's just too street-level vernacular.
Senator Carlson, that's what it is. Yes. That's the idea.
Yes. Mr. McMahon, sorry. I'm looking at Senator McMahon.
I'm from Bermuda.
Chair Fischbach, Senator, you have it absolutely right. If we misuse our data, We welcome the opportunity to deal with these issues in the court of law. We have about 12,000 students per year within the state of Minnesota who are residents of the state of Minnesota who come to our institutions and qualify for a Minnesota state grant. In order for those 12,000 students to receive their state grant, we are required under state statute to provide to the Office of Higher Education data on all of our students. What this bill addresses is when we are required to share that data with the Office of Higher Education, and the Office of Higher Education or a party they contract with have some sort of violation of the data. That's where the elimination of the liability comes into play. But if we misuse the data in some way, shape, or form, the liability still stays with us.
Senator Carlson.
So then if you've transferred this information to the Office of Higher Education, if they have a breach, they're still going to be liable, correct, because of their mishandling of the data. It's just that it will not flow back to That's the essence. So someone's still going to be liable for mishandling the data.
Senator, who wants to answer? Senator
Carlson, this is not an immunity statute for the Office of Higher Education. It is solely for an institution of higher education that provides the data to the Office of Higher Education.
Further questions? Senator Miller, I'm assuming you want to make the motion, renew your motion to recommend it to pass and refer to the Judiciary Committee?
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Next on our agenda, we have Senator Sharon with Senate File 897, and I understand there's several folks who want to testify on the bill, and if they'd like to join her at the table. I have Dr. Wright and Mr. Miskanis.
Thank you, Senator Fischbach. Would you like me to begin?
Whenever you're ready, Senator.
Thank you. I'm here presenting the Senate File 897, which is the governor's proposal for funding for higher education. I have with me people to answer questions later. The order I'd like to take, if it's agreeable with you, is to present the bill. We will answer questions that the committee might have if I'm unclear in my presentation, and then we'd like to close with a statement from our commissioner, Wright.
Please, Senator Sharon. Proceed however you think will work best.
I'll be presenting the governor's proposal for funding higher education in the 2011-2012 budget years. This budget was prepared by the governor and honors certain principles and values he believes Minnesota holds with regard to higher education. Governor Dayton believes investment in higher education is the only long-term solution to economic prosperity for our state, not only for business maintenance and growth, but also economic growth for individuals who have not yet shared the American dream. Countless Minnesotans are eager to become educated so they can participate fully to the level of their ability in creating a strong economy, growing the middle class, and expanding the researchers and the entrepreneurs whose creativity will be the engine for the next dynamic expansion of our commercial enterprise. This budget was developed to maintain the interrelationship of segments of higher education without overregulating and maintaining flexibility. The budget seeks to balance the interrelationship between the academic core of quality in a curriculum, which is the product for which the student is expending tuition and for which the state has an interest. And it seeks to balance the interrelationship between that academic core of quality and curriculum and the concern for the core issues of accessibility by providing protection of state grants and funding levels that allow campuses to contain tuition increases. And finally, the interrelationship between core quality curriculum, concern for issues of accessibility, and core concerns of the campus's operations. A final component of the governor's frame of reference in preparing his budget and the architecture of this bill is that it be realistic, responsive, and sustainable through flexibility. So with that, you'll each have a copy of the bill, and we can move through it. In Section 1 of the bill, the summary of appropriations, these changes are only in effect for years 2012 and 2013, and they are not ongoing changes in statute. Any changes in statute are identified in Article 2. Under the summary by fund, it just would note that it's a 6% reduction from the general fund, or a reduction of $171 million. Moving to page 2. summary by agency by all funds. I will pass through that. It just simply breaks it out and comes to the same totals under Section 2. This is a boilerplate language that sort of defines what the fiscal year is and what its definition is. Then we move to the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Under the total appropriation, again, this is a reduction of about 4.9% for the biennium. The state grant program under which is under the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, in this there is no cut from the previous budget biennium. There also is a formulation to protect the most low-income students because of no cuts to the state grant program. The governor is believing that this is the best way to keep accessibility for the most students. There's an important point to make at this point that even though the state grant program is protected, that the demand for this grant program is expected to increase and that the demand will exceed the appropriation by over $34 million due to increased enrollment. And therefore, the language that we already have in statute related to rationing will come into place. The tuition maximums that we use to apply the state grant against remain in place, and I think you might be interested to know that it also funds at $100,000 per year the Public Safety Officer Survivor Grant Program. It was passed by the legislature. Moving then to page 3, I think it must be. Under child care grants, there is a 5% reduction. Under the state work study program, there is a 32.7% reduction. The Indian scholarship program is reduced by 5%. This program, by the way, was transferred from the Department of Education to the Department of Higher Education in the 2007 budget. And it provides about $3,300 per person. It covers about 600 students, and there are 600 on the waiting list. And again, this is a part of the principle that I mentioned earlier about providing access to the lowest income, those who are eager to share in economic prosperity. Intervention for College Attendance Program. This is a competitive grant program. There are 22 organizations that participate in this grant program. Through this receipt of this grant, these 22 organizations tutor students to stay involved in college readiness programs, a lot of counseling. Some of the money is used by the organizations to help students stay and be successful in college. It helps achieve student gaps in their learning so that they can be successful at college. And that is, in essence, what the intervention for attendance programs is. Let's see. The Midwest Higher Education Compact. This is a program that's held at $95,000 per biennium or per year in the biennium. This is a payment that goes, the compact is made up of 10 states, and it is a compact that all of the states have joined into in order to do group purchasing and to reduce the costs of those purchases that is shared then among all of the Midwest Higher Education Compact members. The interstate tuition reciprocity, this money that's identified in 2011 and 2012 is money that will go to the state of North Dakota. There are 25,000 students that use the interstate tuition reciprocity program. The Wisconsin paid Minnesota $9.2 million in 2009. But North Dakota received 3.1 because of the differential in the tuition and because of the reciprocity agreement. So this money is money that's paid to another state. Subdivision 9, which is on page 4, is the Minnesota College Savings Plan. The governor is proposing not to expand this program any further. It does provide that there will still be tax advantages for college savings for families who choose to do that, but the match will no longer be available. Those who are already engaged in the program will receive, for every $4,000 of savings, up to $400 $1,000 per year from the state, but there will be not a further expansion of that program. This program is available to anybody earning under $80,000 per year for the tax year 2010, but no expansion beyond that. Under Subdivision 10, this program is a MinLink gateway to MinTex. It's a group purchasing program. Again, there is a 5% reduction. The outreach programs, 5% reduction. Agency administration, a 5% reduction. It's a reduction of about $263,000, or a 5% reduction. And the agency administration indicates that they will achieve this reduction mostly through attrition, realignment, and they've been able to negotiate better lease agreements. Balances forward, that simply is standard language. Under Subdivision 14 transfers, this language simply provides the authority to transfer unencumbered balances with written notice to the chairs of the Senate and the House of Representatives committees with jurisdiction over higher education. Section 4, the Board of Trustees of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities total appropriation. This is about a 6% reduction to the overall Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I think that's all I'll say about that. It's about, except to remark that we are making this 6% reduction, which really takes the MinSCU system back to 2001 levels of funding, even though they are serving about 40,000 more students. So that's an implication of this budgetary cut. Central office and shared services is reduced around 6%. Operations and maintenance is a reduction of 6%. Learning Network of Minnesota, which is about offering high speed to all members of the system, is reduced 6%. There's a relationship here with K-12 and libraries in the University of Minnesota. The Board of Regents, University of Minnesota funding is reduced by 6%. I think I'll move down to Subdivision 3, which is the Primary Care Education Initiative. Just to point out to members of the committee, to remind them that this is healthcare access funds, and it's not reduced, Agricultural Extension Services, in this bill, there is a 6% reduction to the Agricultural Experiment Station and Minnesota Extension Services. Health Sciences, this money comes from the general fund. It's a 6% reduction. Minnesota College, Section C and D, the Institute of Technology and the System Special, which are defined under the Institute of Technology for the Geological Survey and Talented Youth Mathematic Program, as well as the System Special for general research at the university, is reduced by 6%. And in this bill, under E, the University of Minnesota Mayo Foundation Partnership, which we have just recently discussed in an earlier bill, is reduced by 6%. Subdivision 5 on page 7, the Academic Health Care Center. This appropriation for the Academic Health Care Center it comes from tobacco money, and it is a constant appropriation. And this is the money that is used to draw down money from the National Institute of Health, money that is used for a variety of purposes, including the health schools at the University of Minnesota, research at the Minnesota Veterans Programs at the University of Minnesota, healthcare programs. Section 6 is the Mayo Clinic. There are, in the governor's budget, there are no cuts to the appropriations to the Mayo Clinic. It might be of interest to you to know that this is money that's used for about 27 residents per year. Now we're about to move into Article 2. This is more technical language, and I will turn this over to whomever of my additional testifiers would like to describe this section of the bill.
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. Section 1 here is one that the the agency would like to ask be deleted from the bill. This is a case where basically we made a mistake. The problem that we were trying to fix had to do with people who are former residents of Minnesota, moved to another state, and then might potentially attend online and be still eligible for a state grant or other state financial aid. But frankly, the solution we proposed causes more problems than it would fix, and so we'd like to withdraw it.
Madam Chair, I'll move to delete Section 1.
Now, Section, just to confirm, Section 1, it would be line 7.26 through 8.25.
Correct.
Senator Pappas moves the deletion of Section 1. All in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The motion does prevail.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, let me speak to Section
Mr.
2.
Mr. Canis.
Mark Canis with the Office for the Record. This has to do with a self-loan program. You see the title there on lines 8.27 as the self-loan revenue bond annual certification. But it's more commonly referred to as a moral obligation. And essentially the way this works is that should the self-loan program, which is self-supporting, we issue bonds and students pay us back, should there be a shortfall either in the debt reserve fund or in anticipated principal payments, the language allows the office to certify the amount we need to the governor, and the governor would then be required to include those in the next budget request he makes to the legislature. So essentially it's a backup for the people to buy the bonds. This was passed 2 years ago. We only used this for the first time late last summer and into the fall when we issued about $55 million of bonds. There's a great deal of interest on the part of both the rating agencies and the bond underwriters. And we had felt that we had an understanding of the interpretation of the timing of this. That interpretation actually was in agreement with the Department of Management and Budget, met with Jim Showalter at the time, Kathy Cardell. However, the bond counsel for the underwriters felt it was to be read a different way. So we're simply here to, this is more technical than anything, trying to clarify the timing of the request that would be made to the governor. And this the change is actually in accordance with what our understanding was and what MMB's understanding was all along.
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, Section 3 is an amendment to statutory language that obliges our office to provide planning information for post-secondary education in the hope that, starting in seventh grade, in the hope that students will be take the kinds of classes they need to in middle school and high school and be able to go to college. And it has to do on line 10.6 with the repeal of the Achieve Scholarship Program. The governor's recommendation is to repeal that program. And so here it's deleting a reference to that program, since if the program isn't going to be funded, we shouldn't be telling students about it. And then later on in the repealers, there are a set of sections that would repeal the Achieve Scholarship Program. Sections 4 through 10 have to do with the phase-out of the matching grants in the Minnesota College Savings Plan. The Minnesota College Savings Plan itself will continue to exist. It's called a 529 plan under that Internal Revenue Code. But there have been, in addition to the basic savings plan, there have been matching grants for students from families with incomes under $80,000, and that program is being phased out in the governor's recommendation. And so sections 4 through 10 make the changes necessary to phase out that matching grant program. Section 11, there was an inconsistency in statute. There's this small program called the Public Safety Officer Survivor Grant Program, and in one place it says students are eligible for up to 10 semesters altogether, and another place it says 9, and we're trying to be consistent and make it 10 in both places. This is a little different than the state grant program, where they have up to 8 semesters of eligibility. But this is a very small population of students whose parents or spouses were killed in the line of duty as a peace officer. Then Section 12 is the repealer. Clause A under that is the Achieve Scholarship Program being repealed. Clause B is the portions of the College Savings Plan Matching Grant Program being repealed, and it has an effective date that is a year later because we want to be able to match the contributions that were promised to contributors for tax year 2010 and then not have any contributions after that. And then Clause C is another portion of the achieved scholarship language.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Sharon or anyone from the office. Why is the recommendation to repeal the matching state match for the college savings plan? What's the rationale for that? Don't we want people to save for college?
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, this plan has been in place for a long time. This was, again, I think as we when you originally brought the governor's recommendation to you, this was one of the very difficult choices to be made. Yes, I think it is important for low-income people to save for college. But if you recall, the original appropriation for this was $1 million a few years ago. It was reduced to $750,000 I think 2 years ago. Now our anticipated spending is about $350,000. We use the term take-up rate, but the application is simply not very strong. It's really hard for low-income people to save much. And some of these grants are very small amounts. They can be $25 for a match. So it just, in the general scheme of things, seemed to be that kind of a program.
Further questions, Senator Tomasoni.
Administrative work.
To that point, you have to put in at least $200 a year before you can get matching money.
Up to $4,000.
It's not just $25, but it looks like it's not going to be effective until July 1st of 2012, correct? Does that match the other dates in the repealer?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Grimes.
Senator, the reason that it's being done that way is that the plan has already been marketed to families assuming that the contributions they made in tax year 2010 would be matched. So by funding the program in the first year of the biennium but not after that, it enables us to fulfill those commitments to those families. And from here on out, the marketing will be such that the families will not be promised that matching grant, and so we won't have the obligation to fulfill. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Senator Tomasoni.
Didn't you say there's something in the repealer in regards to that? Because the effective date on 1215 is July 1st, 2012 of Section 10. And I thought you mentioned, I thought you said something about there being something in the repealer also.
Ms. Grimes.
The idea is that we will pay most of the matching grants in July 2012, okay?
I'm just trying to find out if the date
Senator Tomasoni.
In July 2011, I'm sorry.
Ms.
We will
Grimes.
Pay most of the matching grants in July 2011, and that will enable us to fulfill the commitments made for contributions made in tax year 2010.
Senator Tomasoni.
I don't care about that. You've got an effective date of July 1st, 2012 in Section 13, right?
Right.
And then I thought I heard you say something in that there's an effective date in the repealer that's different. And so I'm just asking you if that's the case.
Ms. Grimes.
The three sections that are being amended and the repealer all would take effect. Oh, I'm sorry. It says July 2nd, 2012 instead of it should say July 1st, 2012. That is a mistake.
One day.
I wasn't looking at that.
Senator Tomasoni.
But both things take effect the same.
Ms. Grimes.
Are meant to take effect the same day.
Okay. All right. That's all I wanted to know.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. On the college savings plan, if there isn't a match, is there still a benefit for families to put money in there? Is there a fairly good rate of return? Have the investments been well made, and are people seeing their funds grow?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, the plan is structured so that if the closer your child gets to the college age, you're into more conservative investments. The younger your child is, you can actually be a bit riskier. There are limits on what you can invest in. But the plan, like any other investment, took a big fall off back in 2008 and 2009, but it is up substantially now. The assets are up over nearly $800 million compared to, I think, something below $600 million. 2 years ago. So because these are investments in equities, there was a swing.
Senator Roebling.
And I'm just wondering, if families invest in this, Because it's for a college education, is there tax deductibility on the gains?
Madam Chair, Senator, the interest earnings are not subject to federal income tax, so it's essentially a tax-sheltered way of saving for college.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling.
So there still is some incentive for people to invest in it and put aside money for college. Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, going back to my old minority days, but on line 426, and maybe counsel can help me, we had to routinely use language, I think along the lines of after chairs, maybe and ranking minority members. In areas like that. And there's another one on line
631.
Yes. That has been standard language. I would move that orally if that's appropriate.
Senator Senjum moves, and it looks like Senator Sharon agrees.
Yes.
And supports the amendments that on lines 4.26 and I guess line 6.31 is what you, the other one you mentioned, that and the ranking minority members. Is that the correct language?
Singular.
Member? Would be added to those. Is that, would that, Mr. Fuller, would that work? Is that sufficient? On the, yes, I'm getting in the yeah, okay. On that motion, on Senator Senjum motions to include that, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion will prevail. Further discussion.
If there are no further questions, then I'd like to invite Commissioner Wright to make a closing statement.
Certainly, Dr. Wright.
And then is it the intent to lay this on the table?
I think to lay it over, yes, Senator Sharon, if that.
That's acceptable.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Wright.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Sheila Wright. I'm director of the Office of Higher Education. And I am here today not just as the director, but as someone who cares deeply about the future of higher education in Minnesota. I know that each of you serving on this committee shares in this commitment to our students, to our institutions of higher learning, and we all want to do the best to preserve and support the state's economic vitality. When it comes to solving our state's budget deficit, without a doubt, a shared sacrifice is both appropriate and necessary. In fact, more than 8 years, higher education in Minnesota has been a part of our solution in meeting our budget deficits. And as a result, funding for higher education has dwindled, has been slashed dramatically, tuition has increased by more than 90%, and program options have been eliminated, along with many faculty and staff positions, both personally and professionally. I believe Minnesota students, their families, and our institutions of higher education have sacrificed enough. And that being said, all of us in this room understand that further cuts to higher education are forthcoming. However, as I said previously to you once before, and as Einstein once said, we cannot solve problems at the same level of thinking that created it. And what we need is substantially a new way of thinking if we are all to survive. Therefore, let us be cautious and thoughtful on where additional cuts are made, not just for the sake of our students, but also for the economic strength and vitality of the state. I have mentioned to you previously the Georgetown University report that by 2018, Minnesota will face a historic demand for jobs. 152,000 new jobs will require new technology and skills to compete in our global marketplace. Combined with vacancies created by our aging population and their subsequent retirements, we will need to fill over 900,000 positions, 70% of which will require some post-secondary education. and many will require advanced or what we call graduate degrees, training or retraining in new technologies. The simple truth is this: we cannot meet this demand without a vibrant and proactive college and university system, as well as affordable pathways for our students to enter higher education, so that every student in Minnesota who chooses and is eligible can pursue this path. We also cannot forget that when we cut funding for higher education, we impact not only our own lives, but those of our students. Keep in mind that all of the appropriations that come to the Office of Higher Education go to support financial aid and programs for students from low and lower middle income backgrounds, programs for students who have been historically underrepresented in higher education. Any cuts then have the potential to limit their access to higher education for many, many of our students, to increase their debt, possible debt, and to extend the length of time they have for degree completion. We know that any cuts beyond those more than what the governor has proposed will not just dramatically increase possible tuition and reduce state aid. They could eliminate critical programs for our students, programs that they depend on, such as work study and child care grants. Now, Minnesota has a rich tradition of strong, strong schools and eager students and well-educated workforce. The appropriation decisions that we make this year will help determine whether or not these traditions continue. And when it comes to higher education, I urge us all to think creatively, to think boldly, and always with an eye to the future, but think with your hearts and your mind, as well as with our emotions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Fischbeck, and thank you very much to all the testifiers. And if there aren't any further questions, we'll lay this on the table for consideration in the
Senator Sharon, you want to make the motion just to lay it over?
For consideration,
Senator,
yes.
Sharon makes the motion to lay it over for consideration, possible inclusion, I suppose. All in favor, or on that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Thank you all for giving us information on that bill.
Senator Fischbach, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, whenever you're ready.
Go ahead.
Senate file 695 we have before us as amended. I believe we're on the second engrossment, and I think that you've got that in your packets. It makes human cloning unlawful in the state of Minnesota. The bill defines human cloning, and in subdivision 5 on page 2, I'm working off the old, but it explains the penalties for violation. We actually did pull out most of that, and so there's very short penalties, and it's a misdemeanor. And then there's a severability clause there at the end. But this is, we have amended it several times so that there are some things that we added and took out to in two of the other committees. It has been through the Health Committee and through the Judiciary Committee. So I would just need to go through here to pass through to the floor. And I believe there is one. Andrea Rao from MCCL did sign up, but she had another committee that she had to be at. So I believe Jordan Bauer is here today.
Welcome, Ms. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jordan Marie Bauer, and I'm here on behalf of MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. a grassroots organization with over 70,000 member families and over 240 chapters across the state. I'm here today to urge you to pass Senate File 695. Minnesota passed a two-year prohibition on state funding of human cloning in 2009. Therefore, the state has already made clear that it does not support or encourage human cloning. This bill takes the next logical step and prohibits human cloning, not just the funding of it with tax dollars. Everyone in this room knows what human cloning is, maybe not the scientific terms, but the end result of the action. Simply put, human cloning is making a genetic copy of another entire human, starting with an embryo. The process used to do this is called SCNT, or somatic cell nuclear transfer. After the embryo is created, through this process, it could either be implanted in a womb or it could be destroyed for research. This legislation does not include any other forms of research other than human cloning or SCNT. I also wish to point out that the director of the University of Minnesota Stem Cell Institute testified last week that this legislation would not affect any research that the university is currently engaged in. Leading researchers and scientists, including Ian Wilmot, the scientist responsible for Dolly the Sheep, and many others have turned away and against from human cloning, even for so-called therapeutic purposes. They have found that cloning of animals does not work very well and that the other new techniques offer much more promise in providing practical applications. We believe Minnesota ought to be at the forefront of cutting-edge research, and human cloning would move our state in the wrong direction. We would be in good company by joining dozens of other countries and a number of other states, countries like France, Canada, and Germany, who have all banned human cloning. So I urge you to listen to the vast majority of Americans who believe that human cloning is wrong and to vote today to ban human cloning in Minnesota. Please support Senate File 695, and I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Bauer or Senator Fischbach?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thomason.
I'm just curious. We outlawed funding of human cloning, I think, for a two-year period. So and this is all new language in this bill. So are the definitions in this bill the same as the definitions in the state law that has outlawed the funding of human cloning?
Ms. Bauer?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, the definition in this bill is not completely identical word for word to the definition that is in law. The definition that in law is a little bit different, but this definition here in this bill was testified to last Thursday by the university that this was indeed the correct definition of human cloning as well.
Do we know the difference? I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Do we know the difference between the definition here and the definition that's in current law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I don't have it. Neither of us have it in front of us here.
Senator Latz, I had you first, and then Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Bauer, you mentioned other countries and states that have banned human cloning. Do they also use the same definition of human cloning as is used in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I haven't looked at every single one of their laws relating to human cloning, although the ones that I did list prohibit both banning human cloning for both the purposes of reproduction, which would be implanting that cloned embryo in a womb, and for so-called therapeutic purposes, which would be using that cloned embryo for research and later destroying it.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be interested in seeing that language, because my understanding is that from the bill that appeared before us in judiciary and here now, the definition of human cloning, at least as scientists use it, has a lot to do with the purpose and not just the scientific technique that's involved. But I anticipate we'll hear from Dr. Wagner for some clarification on the scientific definition of human cloning.
Senator Sharon.
I'm just going at the definition a little different approach. Even though you may not know the exact language, there was an interest in changing the language defining human cloning. So perhaps you can tell me explicitly what the implications of the change of the language have in terms of what it would be allowable or not allowable, especially in relationship to research.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I guess I need a little more explanation. I'm not quite following what definitions you're in this as opposed to the current language. Is that what you're asking?
Correct.
The statutory?
Senator Sharon.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I just have to say, given that neither of us have that language in front of us, I can't tell you exactly how it was changed. So we don't have the statutory language in front of us.
We can get
the
it.
Current statutory language.
Mr. Fuller, Mr. Chairman. Mr.
Fuller. Senator Pappas.
I think Mr. Fuller is looking for it right now.
Ms. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, the practical implication of the language that was passed 2 years ago would have prohibited and did prohibit the funding for both therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning. So while the language in terms of the definition may not be absolutely identical, the practical implications are the same.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from the committee? Mr. Fuller, do you have that available? Do you want to share that with us?
Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert on this. The law I'm looking at is the appropriation to the University of Minnesota in 2009. And I think there may be another law they're talking about. I can read it. I'm not an expert on what the science means. I can't explain the difference to you.
Would that help the committee if Mr. Fuller read that? Please read. Thank you.
This is... Mr. Chairman, members, this is from the 2009 appropriation to the University of Minnesota, and it's in a subdivision entitled Human Cloning Prohibited. An appropriation in this section to the University of Minnesota must not be used to either support human cloning or to pay for any expenses incidental to human cloning. For the purpose of this subdivision, quote, cloning means generating a genetically identical copy of an organism at any stage of development by combining an enucleated egg and the nucleus of a somatic cell to make an embryo.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Any other questions or discussion? Senator Lett.
So, Mr. Chairman, what it sounds like is that in 2009, the legislature said, we're not going to use taxpayer dollars for this purpose. But it was apparently it was acceptable to the legislature and governor at that time, or certainly wasn't prohibited, that researchers using funding sources other than state taxpayer dollars would be permitted to continue to utilize that technique that was there defined as human cloning for research purposes, therapeutic purposes, i.e. purposes of trying to find cures to disease. And the bill before us takes the next step and not only bans it, but makes it a crime.
Mr. Mayor.
To a crime subject to potentially 90 days incarceration. Not only to engage in that particular form of scientific conduct, but also to ship or to receive or to import any aggregation of cells that would meet this definition, including, I suppose, if a person were to travel out of state to receive therapy that was created, the introduction of a medical therapy to cure a disease that had been created using this method of science, and attempt to return to the state they would be importing those cells and would be committing a crime simply by themselves coming home to Minnesota. So this bill is much, much more broad than simply an appropriation change, as I'm reading this bill. But I'd be curious to hear Dr. Wagner's take on all of this, too. I understand there was no scientific testimony presented from the university's side at all at the Health and Human Services Committee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, that's not – they did not contact anyone. They did not contact the Health and Human Services Committee. The bill was posted. So if there was no – if there was no testimony – then it was not of the fault of the committee or the author, because it was posted, and I made contact with them afterwards, and then they were obviously at the Judiciary Committee but did not care to meet with me. So if there's no testimony, it was simply because of they didn't wish to or care to or know about it, or I don't know, but that was not that's not something that was something I did.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't pointing fingers, although Senator Fischbach appears to be thinking that I did. But from what I understand, the university, or at least the scientists associated with the university, were at the Health and Human Services hearing in the afternoon when the bill was originally scheduled to be heard. It was not heard that afternoon. It was postponed until the evening, and that individual was not able to stay into the evening. But the committee saw fit then to proceed without receiving any testimony from the other side of the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, so Senator Latz,
the only
person we have on the list that has contacted our committee to testify today is Ms. Bauer from MCCL. We have not been contacted for anyone to sign up, and this is...
Is that the rule?
No, it's not the rule,
yeah,
but I'm just telling you, Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I'm just explaining that they haven't made any effort to explain that they wanted to. I mean, this is the third committee this has been through, and they've not contacted the committees, to the best of my knowledge, about testifying. So if they were unable to, I don't know if they were signed up. I don't believe they were. They had mentioned to the committee CA or chair that they were interested in testifying. So unfortunately, there was no communication as to whether they could stay or not, because I believe that there could have been some allowances made if they weren't able to stay into the evening. So I guess their lack of communication with the committees is also makes it a little more difficult to fit them in when they have schedule issues.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to take up more time, because I hope that Dr. Wagner is here to testify this afternoon. I was told that he would be here. Great. Because I also was told by the university that they thought that, because the majority had said that you're only dealing with budget items initially, that they didn't think this issue would come up during the budgeting process. So I think they were caught a little off guard by the hearings. But I think they are here now to testify.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, this was on the agenda. So they had noticed that this was going to be heard today, and the fact that you were made aware of the fact that Dr. Wagner would be here this afternoon is very interesting, since I, as the chair of the committee, nor my committee administrator, had been made aware of that. So it's an interesting way to handle the committee process, by just telling committee members that they will be here, but not the committee chair or the committee administrator.
Well, looking at the clock and knowing that we have, sounds like another testifier, I'd like perhaps that person to come forwards, since we are at our committee time already. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is John Wagner. I'm at the University of Minnesota, as you know. I'm a physician. I take care of patients, predominantly children with life-threatening diseases. I'm also a scientist working on adult stem cells, not specifically embryonic stem cells, but I serve as a clinical director of stem cell research at the Stem Cell Institute. What I'd like to say is just that my understanding of the bill and its potential impact. Specifically, as it's been stated by Senator Latz, was that This document will ban the use of somatic cell nuclear transfer with the intention of making a specific cell line. That's true. And I think that, you know, we have to remember that this is specifically not a baby. This is an embryo that we're talking about that results from the somatic cell nuclear transfer. That could be used for patient-specific treatments for a variety of diseases, such as diabetes in particular, but also for new diagnostic reagents and other technologies that could be a benefit to the people in the state. It would outlaw the importation of such stem cells developed elsewhere, not just those developed here, and that could also limit the development of new stem cell-based industries that will have an economic impact subsequently, but also would criminalize the patient treated with such therapies outside the state from ever returning home. It's complicated. I mean, to be sure that, you know, this greater public discourse is needed to understand the potential of somatic cell nuclear transfer performed solely for the basis of creating a patient-specific cell line. Why should you care? You should care about this because there are some diseases for which the only possible treatment is somatic cell nuclear transfer. There is no other possible treatment, such as some forms of blindness, epilepsy, and other neurological diseases, which are due to mitochondrial defects. You should care about this because the development of patient-specific stem cell lines may teach us how to better reprogram other stem cell sources, such as those derived from adult tissues, referred to as that induced pluripotential stem cell. That is certainly a hot topic in science today. You should care about this because patient-specific stem cells will eliminate the risk of immune rejection of stem cells used to treat a variety of diseases, such as heart disease, diabetes, and the need for lifelong immune suppression. To be sure, the public needs to understand the risks and benefits of each strategy. It's complicated, as I said. But it cannot be argued that we don't need these patient-specific stem cell lines because there are other alternatives, because they don't simply exist or are not yet proven. At this point in time, we're asking not to be restricted in making a decision whether or not one stem cell line is better than the other. There is an international effort today at unprecedented levels to develop new treatments with lasting effects for spinal cord injury, diabetes, cancer, stroke, heart disease, skin diseases, and the list goes on and on. And there's new embryonic stem cell trials in spinal cord injury and macular degeneration that is the leading cause of blindness in the United States and the world, reaching epidemic proportions. In my opinion, stem cell research must continue to take place at academic institutions like the University of Minnesota. And the reason for that is that there's considerable oversight already to monitor the activities that are going by ethics committees, by human subjects committees, by human stem cell or embryonic stem cell oversight committees, as well as the Food and Drug Administration. Even though my own research is not with embryonic stem cells, my first and only goal is to find cures for children with incurable diseases and adults as well. I think it's premature to know which stem cell is best to accomplish that goal. I know this. I've testified on the state of the science at the United States Senate. I've testified at the National Academy of Sciences. I've testified at the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine and the United Nations. I'm sure that it's no one's intention to speak inaccurately about the science because it's complicated, and I believe the literature has unfortunately been misinterpreted in some cases. But unless the public recognizes what the risk of this bill is and what its intent is, it could be passed or not passed without a true understanding of the true of all the implications. As you've heard today, you know, there is certainly no question that there should be a ban on reproductive cloning, that is the purposeful desire to make a replica of yourself as a human baby. The question comes down to, is this stem cell mass, a group of cells, is that equivalent to a baby? And that's where the controversy starts and ends. And for some people in this room, they will believe strongly that, yes, this is a baby. And others, they will not. And that's where the controversy exists throughout the entire United States. And so far, from all the polls that I've heard, there's been unanimous support by a majority for embryonic stem cell research. My point today is only that just know that there are significant implications by banning this line of research. And I can tell you unequivocally, and I can also point out to you that I did call Dr. Wilmot on Saturday and Dr. Janish, who was brought up on last Thursday, and they support my position entirely, despite what you've heard. It's misunderstanding what they've been saying. What they're saying is that they agree with the ban on reproductive cloning, but not SCNT. So that's where the controversy is. But understand what is known today and what's not known today. And again, I don't want to limit and shut any doors on the research that could potentially save many people's lives, that could bring in hundreds of millions of dollars worth of industry to this state without knowing what the facts are. At the end of the day, if the vote by the people is that they do not want this research, then fine. But I think the way the bill is written now, it's confusing. People will read the title, a ban on human cloning, to mean a ban on human reproductive cloning, and we all agree with that. But I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth. I think that just the public needs to be aware that this controversy has significant implications long-term on the research that is done here with the full intent of trying to be helpful to the public and not destructive.
Thank you, Dr. Wagner. Any questions from the committee? Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Wagner, can you tell me, does an embryo have life?
Dr. Wagner?
An embryo is a group of cells clumped together that has the capacity to have life and become a child if it's implanted into a primed uterus. If it's not implanted to a primed uterus, it has no potential for life. It must be in a primed uterus.
And Dr. Senator Wagner, Brown? Mr. Chair, where does that embryo come from before it can be implanted?
Dr. Wagner?
The embryo can come from two places. One from in vitro fertilization clinics, where these are leftover embryos after an infertile couple has attempted to have a baby. And oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes there are excess embryos. Because the way in vitro fertilization done with given hormones to the mother, oocytes are taken out, these are the eggs, and they're fertilized with the father's sperm. They don't know how many embryos they will be able to obtain early on. And so what will happen frequently is that you may have 5 or 6 embryos and they will implant 1 or 2. And if there's a successful pregnancy and there's no desire for further children, there will be 3 or 4 perhaps left over. Those can be cryopreserved indefinitely. And in those cases, when they decide not to keep them cryopreserved, that is in a frozen state, they're told that they have the option of either just throwing them away or to give them to another infertile couple or embryonic stem cell research. The alternative that we're talking about today is somatic cell nuclear transfer. It's not the union of an egg and a sperm in that particular case. It's me, for example, taking a skin cell from your body and then taking that nucleus out and implanting it or inserting it into an egg. Because of the possibility of that, in some cases, to become an embryo, that's what we're talking about really today. That would be called somatic cell being your skin cell, for example, and taking that cell nucleus and inserting that in an egg after having removed the egg's nucleus. So it's not the typical conception that you and I would think of. And also, I can tell you that right now it is impossible for that to become a baby. But I think that the reason why we all support the potential or the ban for human reproductive cloning is because perhaps someday in the future that might be possible, although it doesn't exist today. So they're the two methods of how you would develop, quote, an embryo. But the way that embryo develops is totally different. Between a man and a woman, it's the fertilization of that egg's nucleus, or the coming together of the two nuclei, I should say. In this case, the nucleus is already developed in you or I, and inserting that into an oocyte.
And Mr. Chair, Dr. Wagner, are you telling me the process you just described, we cannot get the same results from adult stem cells? Is this only?
Unequivocally.
Dr. Wagner.
Okay.
Unequivocally, we cannot get the same results with adult stem cells.
And Dr. Wagner, Mr. Chair, I'm confused as to when an embryo becomes a baby. Does science have a position on that?
Dr. Wagner.
A baby would be defined as the result of 9 months of gestation and having a baby come out of the womb.
So, Dr. Wagner.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, what you're saying is prior to 9 months, it's not a baby?
No,
Dr. Wagner.
Prior to 9 months, it's not called a baby. It's called a fetus.
Okay, that's where I would differ. Thank you.
Any other questions for Dr. Wagner? Senator Letts.
I'll defer to
Pappas.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think that any of us on this committee would disagree that we should ban human cloning. And I would guess that the University of Minnesota would also agree with that. They may even have a position an ethical position on it right now. We could ask Dr. Wagner, does the university have any specific position on, as you would define, human cloning?
Dr. Wagner.
Like reproductive cloning.
We are full in agreement and have a position that we would ban human reproductive cloning.
So, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Wagner, the difference then is that this bill goes farther than that, as I think you've explained, and also would ban therapeutic cloning. And the concern then is that this has a lot of research potential to deal with diseases that we don't have cures for right now, and that it also, I would say, would have a chilling effect on our ability in Minnesota to be a strong research state. Because if the word is out that the that we ban certain types of research, that research might go other places. In fact, I heard the other day that there have been several researchers at the university that have already been approached by research institutions in California saying, we're pro-research, you know, come and work in our state. Have you heard anything like that, Dr. Wagner?
Dr. Wagner?
I've been approached by Stanford. The California Institute of Regenerative Medicine is actually putting out an RFA to recruit people from other states.
Senator Letts.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that, Dr. Wagner, some of those inquiries have occurred just since the introduction or in reaction to the introduction of the bill we have before us today?
Both.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Letts.
Dr. Wagner, have you had a chance to give any thought to what the financial impact might be? I mean, aside from losing internationally renowned researchers, which common sense says we would also lose a lot of NIH research dollars and a lot of jobs as their labs and assistants go with them. But have you given any thought to what kind of a financial impact that would have on research at the U or on spinoff business?
Yes, we have thought a great deal
Dr.
about
Wagner.
That. I'm sorry. We have thought a great deal about that. Because of the potential of human embryonic stem cell research, we are talking changing the practice of medicine. We're talking about changing the way we do pharmacologic studies for diseases for which there is no disease model that you can create with embryonic stem cell lines. We are talking about new diagnostic reagents. To give you an example, we know that stem cells like to be next to stem cells. We know that we can actually put nanoparticles in stem cells, and they actually will track and look for malignant stem cells, such as in brain tumors, and be able to diagnose where residual disease is that we couldn't otherwise detect. So it's not just tissue repair. These are ways of diagnosing where malignant cancer cells are sitting that we couldn't otherwise find. And now we have a potential way of finding new treatments that would target those areas. So when we talk about what is the potential economic implications, I think that to be conservative on the cheap end would be hundreds of millions of dollars. But there's a great deal of work to be done to be able to achieve that. But the potential is massive.
Senator Letts, follow-up?
Just a follow-up. If I understand sort of the discussion you had with Senator Brown, I mean, the fault line here really and the reason that the MCCL is pushing this is because of the, on the one hand, the position that as soon as you have an embryo that has a nucleus in it, even if it's only 8 cells large, if left in a petri dish, it would die. But if implanted in a primed uterus, it could grow into a fetus and then into a baby, as you've defined it. And at some point between the initial insertion of the nucleus into the egg, creating the embryo, and the development of a differentiated life potential or group of cells, and then beyond that, different people will disagree on where to draw the line as to what is a life or what is a human life or what is, you know, where we're drawing our definitions. And essentially what the bill we have before us is drawing that line at the moment that the nucleus is inserted into the embryo, regardless of whether it's in a uterus, regardless of whether it could ever survive beyond 4 or 5 days. I mean, you're talking in a stage of 2 or 3 days of development, as I understand it. And we're all going to have sincere many of us will have sincere disagreements about where to draw that line. I, for one, do not believe that we're dealing with a grouping of cells that needs to be more regulated unless it's specifically for the purpose of creating a duplicate human being. But if the purpose is create some stem cells that can then be used uniquely to treat disease or to diagnose disease, and particularly to overcome a particular patient's own immune system, because if it's their own DNA, it's their own nucleus that's in there, their body won't reject it. They won't have to take immune-suppressing drugs for the rest of their life if they're successful in avoiding the body's destruction of the own of its own therapy. It seems to me that that is a goal well worth achieving or attempting to achieve. But also, it's well within the ethics and the morals of where I would define, draw that line. I guess that's where I'm coming from.
Mr. Chairman?
Looking at the clock, I'd like to try to wrap this up. Senator Fischbach,
and Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, I was going to make that same suggestion, given that we have, I think we're almost 20 minutes over our time. And this bill has been through several committees. This is its third committee. And so I would like to make the motion or renew my motion that the bill be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
Senator Fischbach has a motion to pass Senate File 695 onto the floor.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask for a roll call vote and request that it be recorded in the journal.
And, Mr. Chair, you need 3 members to request it be printed
okay.
in the journal.
And we have 3 members, so we'll do that. So roll call vote will be taken.
Senator Fischbach.
Yes.
Senator Brown.
Yes.
Senator Carlson.
Yes.
Senator Gimsey.
Yes.
Senator Latz.
No.
Senator Miller.
Yes.
Senator Pappas.
No.
Senator Peterson.
Yes.
Senator Roebling.
Yes.
Senator Saxhog is absent. Senator Sundjom.
Yes.
Senator Sharon.
No.
Senator Tomasoni.
No.
Okay. So it looks like the total of 8 votes to 4, Senate File 695 passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you know, we'll meet Wednesday. The bill will be ready in the morning. We believe it'll be ready in the morning. And then Wednesday, not more, I don't have it in front of me, so yes. And then we will...
Okay.
We had a little bit of a delay with some changes and getting it ready. But and then Wednesday afternoon we will are we doing testimony Wednesday afternoon, and then in the evening we'll have amendments. Yep.
Senators.
So plan for a late session on Wednesday.
On the budget bill?
Yes.
On the budget bill.
One day?
Wednesday.
One day.
Wednesday.
On the budget bill.
That's
one
typical.
The
one, yeah,
right.
The old
Senator Pappas.
Oh, okay, maybe later in the afternoon.
Is there any other business? Seeing none, Senate Higher Education Committee is adjourned.
So, Senator Sundjom, so not only do we have this committee on Wednesday night, but I also have Commerce Wednesday night and your committee.
Services.
It was a surprise. Are you just doing floods? Is that what you're doing?
Well, we were. Thank you. We are, and we're because.